Well, hi everybody. Father Alex here, host of the Godcast. Welcome to another episode. I am the vicar of St Matthew's Church in Burnley. I am the host of the Godcast, and I'm also the author of the book Our Daily Bread, From Argos to the Altar, A Priest's Story, which is available online and in all good bookshops. My guests this week are Depeche Mode Tribute Act, The Devout, and we're looking forward to meeting and chatting to these guys. Many of you will know I'm a huge fan of Depeche Mode, and I can't yet get those guys onto the Godcast, but I'm sure The Devout will be a wonderful replacement. So do enjoy this Godcast now with The Devout. Well, I'm delighted to say that joining me on the Godcast this week are the Depeche Mode tribute band, The Devout. Guys, it's absolutely fabulous to get you on. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks, Alex.
Yeah, brilliant. Thanks, Alex. Thank you for having us on.
So just so you know, we've got Barclay and Keith, one member can't be with us tonight. But Barclay, let's start with you. Tell us how the formation of the tribute band came about.
Well, the old incarnation of band was called Speak and Spell, and they were a popular tribute on the UK and the Europe scene for 10 years prior, and Keith was a part of that band as well. And then Paul Wood, he decided he just didn't want to do any more. He had other projects that he wanted to take on, and so they advertised for a replacement to replace him. The auditions were held, of which I was successful, which was wonderful. And then the band went into a sort of transition of becoming the Devout of what it is now, because basically Speak and Spell, that sort of era of the tribute band, the Depeche Mode tribute band, was very synonymous with Paul Wood, and we all agreed that it was a good place to sort of park it there, to leave it here, that as his legacy, which is what he deserves, and then sort of begin anew with the Devout, with new productions, new projections, new personnel, with same core production member behind it all. And yeah, that's how it all came about.
Yeah, and so Barclay, you take on the role, Dave, don't you, in the band. Keith, what was it like? What was it like going through that audition process? Was Barclay your first choice? Was it kind of wow moment? Or
he was at the time. There are a few guys there. A couple of very very good people there. Barclay was the one that everyone in Speak and Spell board had wanted to pick that up. But we decided really, Glenn, who was in the Devout, who I was going to start with, we sort of spoke about it again. We really need to park this up, park up Speak and Spell. And because there had been a bit of a revolving door there, and I think with any of those projects, when they reach a certain point, it's changed so much that it really is better to start it off again, firm foundations, and build it up again. So we decided to rebrand it, rename it, and go over it entirely. Barclay, I think you're breathing on your mic. Go over every song entirely and just rebuild every last one of them, and do them in a way that you can't really do if you're in a successful band that are out playing gigs constantly. You don't get a chance to go over the groundwork again. So with that period, we had a few months there we could get right into the nitty gritty, rebuild everything. Have some good thoughts about how we wanted to do everything, reproduce everything. But part of the studio that I'm sitting in is all part of that. It was all built around going in this new direction of ultra high quality production.
Yeah.
And then we got that off the ground actually before the pandemic hit. We managed to get five or six shows, you know, under the belt before the pandemic hit, and then the pandemic came along, and that was everyone was sort of. Then we found he had another year or thereabouts. So a lot of work happened then. So we, you know, we we've had a chance to really think, really solid think about what we wanted to do, Alex, and how we wanted to do it. And that's how we got, ended up in the position that we're in now.
And where does the love affair begin for you both with the band? Perhaps with you first, Keith. You know, how far does your history go back with Depeche Mode? And then once Keith spoke about you, Barclay, have you, were you always a fan, or have you come to the band as you've got older?
My love affair with Depeche Mode started years ago. I think I was about 13, 12 when I first heard them. And they were on the radar with the first two big singles. See You, Meaning of Love came out, and they sort of skipped me a little bit. I didn't, you know, the fourth or fifth single, I wasn't really that interested. I sort of saw Depeche Mode as a strange haircut 100 type band. I you know, they were very sort of pop. Yeah, it wasn't like it was like the previous two singles. But then when Leaving Silence came out, and a friend of mine came over with the 12-inch from Leaving Silence, he said, "You've got to listen to this." I listened. I thought, "Oh yeah, Depeche Mode." And I was into it then. I thought that was just wonderful. And then Get the Balance Right, Everything Counts, and the more I heard, the more I just fell into it. And my first gig was 1983, and I remember standing there at the Brighton Dome. And glued watching Alan Wilder, transfixed watching everything he did, because by then I was into synthesizers and playing and all the rest of it, and I was hooked. And I've, you know, that's basically most of my life ago. Mm-hmm. And I've not really been able to move on, I suppose. Somehow I'm still transfixed by it, I absolutely love it. And you know, it's never, of the fascination has never gone.
No,
especially with the material up to 1994. How they did that at the time with the technology available, how they produced that work, it's just utter genius.
Yeah,
utter genius for me. Yeah.
What about you, Barclay? Where did your, you know, what was the kind of the beginning starting point for you with your kind of Depeche Mode relationship?
Well, I'm into sort of heavy fandom of Depeche Mode. I came into it rather later. My first love is The Doors. So I love bands that are mired in sort of iconicism and poetry and everything like that. But I remember, I'm a great believer in fate, Alex, and just remember being a teenager and staying up late, probably should have been asleep, but I caught the One Night in Paris Exciter concert, and I liked the sound. It didn't immediately catch me. What did catch me was the couple of the songs, Enjoy the Silence and Personal Jesus, and I found myself singing them the next day. And then a couple of years went by, I had bits and pieces, but it was when I was 17 or 18, I was facing a very low point in my life. And I was just, you know, searching out for music that spoke to me. And I found a recording of Halo. And that was it. I listened to this song. And I got some people that come to our gigs, they ask, well, yeah, because I'm 38 and a lot of our gigoers are late 50s, 60s, and why do the young people get Depeche Mode? And I said, you don't choose Depeche Mode. Depeche Mode choose you. Mm. And once they have you, you've got no choice, mate. You're gone. And so, yeah, that's how I really got into them. And it's been a long love affair since then.
Yeah. It's really interesting listening to you give your examples. I mean, I'm the same. And if anybody's interested, my love affair started with the Some Great Reward album, and I remember seeing Martin sing Somebody, I think it was on the Tube, and I was a teenager, 14-year-old kid, and I saw him in his kind of a handcuffs and a black leather dress, and I was kind of thinking, why do I like this? What is going on here? And then had to get the album, and then you know the sounds and noise of songs like Master and Servant and People on People, and I do think that's a really great album actually. But like you say, it stays with you, doesn't it? You know, I think I was interested to know what you thought about Depeche Mode more recently. I mean, I think like you say, Barclay, once they get you, they've got you, and I think Memento Mori has been a really, really fabulous album on a personal level. But do you find that your audiences want the just can't get enough and in silence, you know?
How we market our approach to Depeche Mode. Basically, if people want that, they went to the tour, they saw the boys do it, saw Martin and Dave doing that tour, so we leave that to them. What we provide is something that they won't be able to access anymore, and that's the nostalgic versions, the electronic versions of Leave in Silence, of Shape the Disease, of all the songs that they know, and when they were in their youth, they used to see Depeche Mode play then. That's what we replicate in our shows. The reason for that is that because I consider that to be like peak Depeche Mode. Of course, they still make good quality music now, but it's not the same raw, passionate, driven electronic music they were making back in the 80s to mid 90s. And, as I said, anyone can go out and try and replicate what they're doing now. But our passion is bringing that feeling of the light bulb moment. So as soon as our version of Photographic kicks in, which is based upon the 1984 Hamburg version, somebody in that audience will go, oh, I remember this. I remember being at that gig in 1984. I remember, and you see it take over them, and they lose it, and it's like a euphoric moment, and they sing and they love it and they clap and everything. It's lovely to see, and it's a real joy to be able to represent that era of Depeche.
Yeah, and Keith, when Barclay says once they've got you, they've got you. What do you think it is about them that sucks us in? I mean, it is extraordinary.
I think I can only speak in my sort of own objective experience. Subjective experience. I, for me, it was initially it was the sounds. The fact that they sounded so different to everybody else. They were layering melodies across each other. I mean, on the first album, Speaker Spell, there's not a solitary chord on the whole album. It's all layered, different melodies, which obviously together collectively make up a chord of sorts. And there are chords on the songs. You know, the songs are written around chords, but there are actually no played chords. And I think it was that unique approach that really sort of sets the things ticking for, you know, a technically inquisitive teenager like myself. But as it went on, I sort of, I think it was as much to do with the imagery and the vibe of it as well, because they did appeal to the outsider, which I think is important. There was always something about the imagery and the music that you put together, and it became more than the sum of the parts. Synergy between the two, the 2 + 2 equaled sort of 5.5. When you look at you know, a lot of the sort of Anton Corbijn images and listen to the music at the same time, there's something that happens between the two pieces that. I don't want to use the word, but I'm going to. It's almost as a spiritual thing. It makes you feel that there's something just a little bit beyond your own experience that's right there, that you can't really grab, but you can be aware of. And that's really what it was for me. And it's moved on and on up to certainly the point where Alan left the band, and then that, you know, they headed in a different direction, and now it's a different thing again because the entire industry has changed. You know, we're at a point now where there's AI writing songs. You know, the entire industry has changed, so we can look back at this period and go, you know, this is maybe some of the maybe possibly the, you know, the last phase of the great songwriters who could really structure songs and really write things and do you know, very intelligently created arrangements and textures and produce, you know, music which you know, which didn't have a leash on it. You listen to something in your room. To me, that is just one of the most incredible pieces of work. And I've always thought this. And Alan has said to me that's like four versions of their original song that sort of came this thing. And in the third verse, there's actually a completely different set of chords that play. And it's this intelligence that runs behind everything, I think, holds. It just allows takes the listener somewhere different, but at the same time, somewhere the same. It's very skilled songwriting.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think I when you touch on the spiritual, you know, here, you know, for people who are listening to this and maybe haven't come across the Godcast, I'm a priest. There is something I think deeply spiritual about the connection of the music to the lyrics. A song that I think that. I don't know if this would surprise you, but I have cited that. I don't think I would be a priest if it wasn't for the music of Depeche Mode. And I particularly cite Blasphemous Rumours.
See, I was going to ask about this.
You know, and because the you talk about things being multi-layered. It was the music, the sound, first of all, that dark, melancholy kind of riff that was going on through the song, and then the lyric comes, and get the line, you know, girl of 18 fell in love with everything, found new life in Jesus Christ. I remember as a kid again thinking, what is this all about? And then they come out with those other gems, you know. I think Flying the Windscreen is another deeply theological song in many ways, you know, when I think about it. Black Celebration and all these tunes. Sorry, go on, Keith.
I've got to say, on this Memento Mori, Soul With Me, the song Soul With Me, I listened to that and I thought, wow, you know, that's almost Imperial Phase Depeche Mode. If that had been written in the 90s and Alan and Flood got their hands on that, Gareth Jones have got their hands on that. I think we have had something. I think we'll have something absolutely timeless.
Yeah,
that's incredible. Really is one of their best.
And what about you, Barclay, as the singer? You know, when you're singing these songs, do they take you to another place, or you know, is it all about the entertainment?
Oh, I tell you what, it is. It does. It's like a not like a possession. That's hyperbole. It is. You tune into the energy, and I am mindful. I'm tuning into a time where, because the Dave I want to replicate was a Dave who was fresh faced, who was energetic, not yet cynical at the world, not yet tired of the world, and not yet embroiled in heroin. It was just that sort of happy, have a go ball of energy of a front man that really, I mean, without that vehicle driving the music, I don't know if they'd have found as much success as they did, because of, you know, you look at your Depeche Mode history and you see the different live performances, like Live in Hamburg, like Black Celebration Tour, like Masses Tour with 101, you've got this sprite just going from one stage to the left, to left, up, down, left, right, up, down, back, it twirling and everything like that. And you cannot take your eyes off him. So you've got a perfect concoction of great songwriting, great production and arrangement, and great performance. And it's just lightning in a bottle is what they got there. And they got it right. So, and when performing some of these songs, like In Your Room especially, you just, it's such a euphoric song to listen to, first of all, and to sing, because you immediately feel at ease in delivering the lyrics, because it's a soul song. It's a soul song to electronic music in my eyes, and people just connect it, and you see them close their eyes, because people don't. It's weird, because, you know, Depeche Mode tributes maybe look to make people dance and have, you know, have a good time, which is fine. But one of the main reasons that our sets are quite long is that we cater to every single Depeche Mode fan out there. Your casual Depeche Mode fan who just wants to hear the hits, to your nerdy Depeche Mode fan, for want of a better word, who wants to hear the deep cuts, who wants to hear the some of the B-sides, who wants to hear some of the album tracks that they just won't hear anywhere else, or not with the versions that we do.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I'm definitely in the nerdy category, I think. Yeah, the more obscure, the better for me. I just wonder what you think, guys, about where Depeche Mode's biggest shift was. You know, I remember I was working in a shop when Songs of Faith and Devotion came out. I remember getting Q magazine or whatever it was, and it could have been Radio 1. It's unlikely to be Radio 1, but I Feel You, I think, was the first single. I might be wrong. I think I Feel You was the first single on that album. And I was thinking, oh, my God, what is this? And I would, at the time, my immediate thoughts was, this is too much of a shift for me from the Violator album. But now, yeah. Now I'm 54. I absolutely adore Songs of Faith and Devotion. I just think it's, I know Violator, and I've got the Violator tattoo under this sleeve. For me, Songs of Faith, I know I've seen it. Mark Barkley's got it as well. But I do think that Songs of Faith and Devotion was almost the perfect storm, where Dave was in free fall, and they all were, weren't they, really? And Alan seemed to get heavily, correct me if I'm wrong, but Alan seemed to really be the driving producer in that album. And what came out in hindsight,
Mark, can you breathe on your mic? I can't hear Alex.
Yeah, was that shift at the time was too much, but now, you know, sometimes it wasn't enough. You know, some of the songs like Condemnation, In Your Room, Walking in My Shoes is my all-time favourite Depeche Mode song. It's so special to me on a personal level. What do you think? Do you agree with what I'm saying, or have you got a different view? Mm.
I do. I remember walking into, I'm 56, I'm a little older than you. I remember walking into a local newsagents and seeing whatever magazine it was. There was Dave with hair all over the place and tattoos and whatnot. I was thinking, oh, what has happened here? And I, you know, and then hearing I Feel You, I thought, good Lord, what is this? But it's only with just listening a couple of times, really starting to get into it. And I got an advanced copy of the album, and I listened to that. And it was on a DAT tape. And I remember listening to it and thinking, oh, I'm not sure about this, because it was very different. You know, Walking in My Shoes, very, very low bass on it. It was all very, it kind of moved with the time as well. It was, because it was a lot of drum loops, played drum loops, then taken from anything. They were played by Alan and used on the album. But the production was very much more of what was happening at the time within music. But married to some extraordinary songwriting and some extraordinary, obviously, production. And I do, I honestly think that album and that tour, especially the tour, just, I don't think it's been bettered by anything, ever. I really don't. And that was a big shift. And was it enough? I think it probably was. But it was a huge shift from Violator.
Yeah.
A huge shift.
And with those Corbin backdrops on that tour, they were extraordinary, weren't they? Do you agree, Barkley, with myself and Keith? Do you have a different take? Or?
This is where I'm afraid I'm going to commit a sin is of envy, because I envy you two so much. Because obviously, only being 38, I've never got to see Masses tour, Black Celebration tour, World Violation tour, Devotional tour, and you lot did. So very envious. But looking at it retrospectively, seeing everything, Violator for me still the superior body of work. And I'll tell you why. It's because you've got nine. I mean, the B-sides could have made the album. I'm just going to say that much. It could have been a longer album. They could have made that a 12-track album easily. No problem at all, but they didn't. And they chose nine tracks that flow together. And I believe, and I said this to Keith when I first, when I was arranging to audition for the band, I said, Violator is like Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. You have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 perfectly measured songs telling a story. And that just really comes into fruition at the end of Violator, when you got Blue Dress that morphs into Clean. Well, Clean has to be one of the best endings to an album ever. It's just a perfect body of work. Songs of Faith Devotion, don't get me wrong, it's got classic tracks on there. But as a complete body of work, I think Violator pips it every time. It is flawless. It is flawless. I can't say anything better than that. It's perfect.
Yeah, and what about the more recent albums, Keith? You know, like Spirit's a good album, isn't it? I think, you know, there's some good tunes on there. But you know, Playing the Angel, they can't be described as classic albums, can they? Because they don't have the, as we've just described, that kind of brilliance from beginning to end. But there are, you know, even on Ultra, there are some songs that are, you know, is it Useless, isn't it? I love the song Useless on the Ultra album. So there are still moments.
There are gems dotted around. Yeah. On, you know, Ultra's got some belters on it. Home. You know,
it's beautiful. Yeah, it's a very clever song.
It's just genius. You know, Exciter's got some absolute crackers on it. I think IMU is wonderful. And there are you know, fantastic songs here and there. I think Child Inside of Delta Machine is another one that really, you know, it's a very, very, very cleverly written song. I struggled with Spirit a lot.
Why, Keith? What was it?
I don't know. I just, something about it just didn't captivate me. I just didn't really understand anything of it.
It kind of shifted away from more, you know.
I can't explain what that one is. I don't know what it is. Yeah. The Spirit for me was just sort of like, oh, what's this?
Maybe it was because they. I mean, because I think it could be Martin that said, you know, we write about death and Jesus and God. Maybe, you know, they did that album did go in a slightly more political route, didn't it? And I think there's quite a lot.
It might have been.
There's quite a lot going on in America.
Yeah, and I didn't. You know, there's it was a bit politic, a bit of politics there, which I think we're, you know, it was, you think about what's happening in the world at the time, it was almost inevitable with some of the nonsense that was happening. But you know, the album itself, it didn't really resonate with me. But Memento Mori is a better affair. But one of the things that I'm going to say is the albums from Speak and Spell up to Songs of Faith and Devotion, I never found a weak point in any of them.
No.
And that's, you know, that I, you know, all the tours, I just enjoyed every second of it. And I still listen to those albums now. You know, I've got an old car with a CD player in it. Six CD slots in it, and guess what are in there? I can't get past those albums. The later albums, we call them post Wilder albums. Maybe,
yeah.
You know, there's something about the texture of those albums.
The fans have to get beyond Alan Wilder, though, don't they? He's not coming back, is he?
He's never coming
back. No. I see these sites where
it's kind of a daft question, you know.
Yeah, it's like, get over it, guys. He's not coming back. You know, it's done. It's dusted.
He's never. I don't think. I'm absolutely certain he's never even talked about ever going back, other than to say I'm never going back. When you think about, you still think about the albums, though. You know, that period there was this richness to them. But at the same time as Alan going, and shortly after, the industry started to change anyway. The way remixes were done, all of that started to change. So, you know, no one really knows what they'd be like had Alan stayed through this new form of music industry. Now, with, you know, sort of the whole thing being much more homogenized and much more sort of product based, you know, but it wasn't so much then, you know, it was less syndicated maybe than it is now. And
yeah, and with your live shows coming up, you're everywhere, aren't you, this year? You're absolutely all over the country. Yeah. What can fans expect then, Barclay, when they come and see you?
Just really good fun time, just with all the hits that they remember, some of which they don't remember. We are very dedicated and very passionate about the show that we put on, and we try and put as much as our energy into it as possible. Not only with the performance, but the pre-production that's gone into it. Of course, we're lucky to have Keith behind a lot of the productions that we've done, you know, 99% of them, just that using his studio to make dedicated backing tracks and instrumentalization, if that's a word, to actually replicate these songs live. And then we've got projections where we could take in the easy route, and we could have, for want of a better word, plagiarized some of Anton Corbin stuff, but we said no. People see us, they know we're not Depeche Mode. We best describe ourselves as fans, entertaining fans, and I like that. That is brilliant, which means that we, in our projections, we parody them. So we parody the Enjoy the Silence video and the Never Let Me Down video, so people can identify with what they're seeing, but also know that it's, you know, we've actually gone that extra mile in sort of putting that element of work together. And that coupled with our bandmate Reza, who does a brilliant Martin Gore, lovely vocal, lovely Martin stage presence. We are there to deliver that Depeche Mode experience that they, of course, being older, the band's older now, different production, they're never going to hear those electronic versions again.
And do you see the crowds growing? You know, Depeche Mode becoming more popular as they get older and you get older?
I think they're massively popular anyway.
Yeah.
They're just hugely popular.
Yeah.
Just think more people are hearing of us.
They're still a cult band. For example, the Never Let Me Down was in The Last of Us, and there was a sudden surge of popularity for that. Just Can't Get Enough is timeless. It's a timeless pop song, so it shows you the magic of Vince Clarke and his genius. Depeche Mode will always be woven into the fabric of British music, and I think that's great. For young lads from Basildon who were from rough areas mostly, they started out this band that took over the world, and it just shows you that, and you know, if you got the passion and the talent and the drive, and you can make it. You can really make it. You just got to want it enough.
Yeah. And Keith, just say, you know, a little bit more of a vintage, slightly older than I am. Just say about Fletch's contribution to Depeche Mode. I was heartbroken when Fletch died. In fact, you know, it still upsets me.
I know
he didn't write the songs, and I know he didn't, but he was Depeche Mode as well, wasn't he, you know?
He was definitely Depeche Mode as well. I only met him once briefly in passing. I don't have great insights, but I think really his passing was has obviously been a difficult time for Dave and Martin, from everything that they've said in interviews and talked about it, and someone that they've worked with their entire lives, to lose him that way. In terms of his contributions to the band, look, everyone knows that he didn't play that much and didn't write and wasn't really so present in the studio, or certainly later. You hear about things, and a lot of people hear about things, but you can also see that, you know, what he did have, he's certainly given and presented some very, very sound advice along the course of their careers. And he has some very, very good ideas. And what I hear, there's an awful lot of that, an awful lot of, you know, very strong direction, and great ideas came from Fletch. So if you view a band in the traditional, it's never a good idea to view Depeche Mode in any traditional sense, because it's exactly what they're not. But if you view a band as a traditional band, you would say, well, every member's got to play something. Every member's got to contribute musically, in which case everyone's going to look at Fletch and go, oh, you know, what did he do? But then, you know, you can ask, well, you know, a lot of bands fall apart because they don't have someone like Fletch.
It's so true, isn't it? I mean, so I think about, it's not think for about me Bez and the Happy Mondays. You know, Happy Mondays wouldn't be the Happy Mondays without Bez.
Exactly. Yeah, no.
You know?
And yeah. I think ultimately... Yeah,
they might never got off the ground.
No.
And ultimately,
Alex... They may never have got off the ground.
Yeah.
There's a human element to this as well, because not only was he in Depeche Mode, but he was a much-loved family man. And our hearts go out to Grania... Mm. And his children, because let's look at it on a personal level, a wife and children lost their husband and father suddenly like that. And it's quite the allegory for Depeche Mode tracks, like life imitates art, isn't it? But it, you know, that's the main thing. It's a human element to this that, you know, you can get into fandom and everything, but at the end of the day, a beloved man was lost, so our hearts do go out to them.
And have you guys had experience of meeting Dave and Martin? Have you met the guys, or
no? Not Dave and Martin.
No.
But you met Alan. Keith. Met Alan, but a bunch of times. Alan's helped out with this studio a little bit. He's donated some bits, and I speak to him sort of periodically. He's a lovely fella, you know. He really is a lovely bloke.
Yeah.
And I met Fletch very briefly. I met Vince, of all places, in a bar in Las Vegas in 2007. I was just at a bar in a Las Vegas hotel, and he was there. So a little chat in 20 minutes.
And is there any prospect of Alan doing anything? I mean, it was Recall, isn't it? But it's all very quiet, and I think fans would... You know, even if it's something on the scale of Vince Clark album, I think people would be interested.
I couldn't say one way or the other, really. It's not for me to say, really. It's Alan's business.
Mm.
You know, he's a good man. I'd love to see him do something, but he's Alan. He's gonna do what he's gonna do. You know, I couldn't possibly say.
He's nothing to prove, that's for sure. And what about favourite tunes, guys?
Nothing at all.
What's the song that you can't wait to sing on the next gig?
Shake the Disease is one of the best songs ever written. It's got perfect lyrics, perfect melody. It's just a brilliant, brilliant little song. It sort of transcends a pop song for me, and I love performing it. I love performing In Your Room as well. But yeah, Shape the Disease is really good.
And Keith?
For me, Enjoy the Silence, or the devotional version of World in My Eyes, I love listening to. It's just gorgeous. Or Walking in My Shoes. In Your Room again. Well, like with the gigs, as they go through and reach a certain point, you go, we're into the... When we do New Life, we're into this set. And all of a sudden... I don't think it's a particular song that I would say listen to in isolation, but there's movements from one song to the next that I enjoy. So we'll play Walking in My Shoes, and then I think it's Walking in My Shoes into New Life, And then, and I enjoy that change. I enjoy that emotional shift. And I think that there's a lot of that. And also, it's the way that the crowds respond as well. You know, we're very, very lucky to get to do this. You know, it's part of life's rich tapestry. To see it, but we do play the stuff that we love, you know, as well. And we don't. One of the big reasons we don't play the later material isn't the fact that we really love the earlier material. It's like Barclay alluded to earlier. It's that we have to know our place. There's no point us playing the last album on us before they've done it, and it's rude. You know, we have to know our place as well. Yeah. So we do. We kind of stick to that comfort zone that we know that a lot of the audience members really want to hear because they want to hear it again. So we do sort of favour the stuff that we like a little bit.
And if people want to know more about you, just plug your wares, if you will, and tell us where we can see it. I know you're not far away from me this Friday. You're in Tomberden in West Yorkshire, aren't you?
Are you coming?
Well, I'm hoping to get there. Yeah, actually, I am hoping to come along. Yeah, I'm just trying to bring some family members, but they're not as keen on Depeche Mode as I am. But hopefully I'll see you there. I do hope to get along. Don't out me, though, will you?
Yeah, we got there he is.
We'll dedicate Blasphemous Remus to you, Alex.
Yeah. You know what, guys? I've always wanted to go and see Depeche Mode, Dog Collar, but I've never done it, and I don't know why. But there's a massive link between my faith and that band, and those words, and those lyrics, and those sounds. So it's very important to me. And you know, my dog, I've got a 20-year-old sheepdog knocking around somewhere. He's called Fletcher. You know, it runs long and hard in my life. And when I was a kid, I remember going around my mate's house. He was a huge Bob Dylan fan, and he had all these records and everything. And I was thinking, you saddo, but I've actually become that guy. You know, I've become that guy.
And I bet you love it.
I love it. I love it.
I bet you're loving being that bloke. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I do. Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, we've got a website, depeshmotribute.co.uk, and there's a Facebook page that's about this long, the Devout Depeche Mode Tribute or something, the Depeche Mode Tribute, the Devout, something like that. That's where you can find us if people are interested in coming and seeing.
Instagram, Devout_mode as well.
That's it.
Yeah, great.
Just before you go, Alex, I love that point that you made. It's like, I suppose accepting Depeche Mode was probably how... the same sort of feeling of accepting God into your life. I know musicians aren't God. That's the point I'm making, is that it chose you. You didn't choose Jesus or God. Yeah. You were chosen.
It's very true that, you know, I you are the first tribute band I've had on, and I've had a lot of really famous musicians on. I had a drummer called Vinnie Coalita. He was in the Hall of Fame for drummers. I asked him about this, and he said, "Music's a heavenly language," and I really liked the way that he described that. I also interviewed Chris Difford from Squeeze, who went through issues of addiction, and you know, he said, "You know, I had to find out where my knees were, and when I found where my knees were, I could find my music and I could find my way back up." And I thought, "My God, this is profound. This is very prophetic," you know. I think it's great that you keep taking that sound out there, and people are coming. You know, I want more and more people to discover Depeche Mode because I think they're an important band that'll be proved in 20, 30 years, 50 years. So, yes, I wish you well, and hopefully see you on Friday. And all the best with the tour, and thanks for coming on the Godcast. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure, Alex. Thank you.
Much love.
That's